Today, brought down by an unlikely burst of friendly fire, the soldier who said too much. 60 years on, and the South Koreans still can't agree how to handle their dangerous neighbour. Two policemen called Gonzales take us out on night patrol in Caracas, one of the world's most violent cities. And the assignment in Oklahoma, which began with the words, "People will die and lives will change forever." It's been a week that General Stanley McChrystal won't forget. The tough commander of the coalition war effort in Afghanistan was summoned to the White House on Wednesday. He and his aides had made critical remarks about the Obama administration, which appeared in Rolling Stone magazine. Would there be just a reprimand? Could the president afford to hand out anything harsher to the man America was banking on to bring the Taliban to its knees? The news came swiftly. McChrystal had been sacked and was to be replaced as commander of NATO troops in Afghanistan by General David Petraeus. My colleague Lise Doucette has spent time with both generals and has given us this reaction to the week's events.
General McChrystal looked down at his boots. He was strangely quiet, distant, as we sat facing each other on straight-backed chairs, waiting to start our interview. I wondered what weighed so heavily on his mind. He was usually so quick to smile and to talk. I knew he had just come from the presidential palace, so questions raced through my mind. Had something gone wrong again with President Karzai or on the battlefield? To break the silence, I simply said, "Tough job." "Yes," he replied, "I just heard my college roommate died. He's been ill." "Oh, I'm sorry," I said. "Would you like more time?" "No," the general insisted, visibly tightening his jaw and sitting up straight. "This is my job." And the general focused. That was General McChrystal in the field, in his element, in command. When I first met him in Kabul a year ago, just after he took up his post, I asked how he would cope with the pressure of being the face of what was being called Obama's war. He smiled with palpable confidence. "I've brought a lot of good people with me." This was Team McChrystal, a tight-knit team of fiercely loyal advisors and aides. Some had worked with him in Iraq. Some belonged to his band of brothers, as soldiers say, from the elite West Point Military Academy. They had graduated in 1976, in the shadow of the Vietnam War, amid deep anti-war sentiment. "It took real courage and commitment to want to be a soldier then," one of his aides once told me. That was the kind of reputation the general brought to Afghanistan. A soldier's soldier. No one talked much about what had really gone on when he headed what's called the most secretive force in the US military, the Special Operations Unit hunting Al-Qaeda militants in Iraq. There was much myth-making around the gaunt commander who slept 4 hours a night, ate one meal a day, and removed cushions from office chairs so visitors wouldn't stay too long. The same kind of tales had emerged about the man who now replaces him, the general who was the face of America's last big war in Iraq. General David Petraeus was also said to sleep little, run a lot, work all the time. I once joked with General Petraeus that he had to spend more time in Afghanistan because he was being outdone in the image stakes by the other hard-charging general. He laughed. "I know about Stan's one meal a day," he said. "He eats one meal a day, all day long." The two men worked closely together. Both said Afghanistan would be more difficult than Iraq. Both were poster boys for a new way of fighting wars. It's called counterinsurgency, or COIN. But General McChrystal put his personal stamp all over it, emphasizing the need to avoid civilian casualties, to protect the population. It earned him rare praise and trust from a most reluctant commander-in-chief, President Hamid Karzai. I saw how that relationship worked when I traveled with them to the southern city of Kandahar in April, at the very moment when relations between President Karzai and Washington were in deep crisis over the president's extraordinary outburst accusing the Americans of perpetrating election fraud in Afghanistan. Would the trip have to be cancelled? No. The president, the general, and their aides huddled together in a special pod in the military plane that took us south. And then they strode into a meeting to face hundreds of tough-minded, plain-speaking tribal elders. The president told the tribesmen of his respect for a general who took responsibility when Afghan civilians were wrongly killed in battles against the Taliban. He stabbed the air with his finger. "When he admits his mistakes, we should forgive him." There was a murmur from the floor at this public endorsement of the American general, even though many of the elders clearly had deep misgivings about his strategy. Back in Washington, General McChrystal was praised as the man who knew how to deal with a difficult ally, unlike almost everyone else on Obama's Afghan team. So what happened to the general's careful touch when it came to dealing with his own president's team? There seemed to be two sides to this general, a careful commander in the field and a coarser one that emerged in the magazine article that brought him down. On that day in early June when we sat together on straight-back chairs in Kabul, he didn't rise to the ringing phrases he had used only weeks before. He rejected again and again reports from the South that his much-vaunted strategy was running into trouble, saying wars never go as planned. On and off the record, he insisted, "I still believe we can win." I walked with him to the door of his office. When we parted, I said, "I'm sorry about your college friend." "No, it's okay," he replied brusquely. "I shouldn't have said it." Weeks later, that's what he's saying, over and over again.
Lise Doucette, and you can hear more of what Stanley McChrystal said in The Runaway General. That's here on Radio 4 tomorrow evening at 9:30. Now, it's a conflict which had several names. To the Americans, it was the Unknown War. In South Korea, the 625 War. China knew it as the War to Resist U.S. Aggression and Aid Korea. It started on the 25th of June 1950, when North Korean troops swept south across the 38th parallel. It went on to draw in 24 countries. It was a vicious affair with heavy casualties. And as John Sudworth tells us now from South Korea's capital, Seoul, it left divisions and scars which have never gone away.
Colonel Malese Tesima stops mid-sentence. He's been telling me about his radio operator, killed in front of him during the Battle of Triangle Hill. It was a brutal death in a particularly bloody battle in one of the 20th century's bloodiest wars, and the 79-year-old softly spoken Ethiopian looks away to hide his tears. Over the past few months, a steady stream of old men from all corners of the world have come back to Korea as guests of the South Korean government, which pays a generous portion of their travel costs. A small way of saying thank you to the United Nations veterans 60 years after they took part in what's often called the Forgotten War. Including the enemy North Korean and Chinese forces and the civilian deaths on both sides, the conflict claimed an estimated 4 million lives. Hell on earth is how I've heard more than one veteran describe it, and quite a few have told me that they vowed never to come back. A lifetime later, they are usually astounded by what they find here. Seoul, once a burnt-out shell of a capital, taken and retaken numerous times over the course of the three-year war, is now a dizzying megacity at the heart of one of the world's biggest economies. With its skyscrapers, six-lane highways, its wealth, energy and style, it is a freewheeling celebration of capitalism that has risen with astonishing speed from the ashes of war. But dig a little deeper, and for many a visitor, foreign correspondents included, the legacy of that conflict can also make it a complex and perplexing place. The war ended in 1953 with a ceasefire, not a permanent peace treaty, and with the border between the North and South more or less where it was when it started. While the South has found its prosperity, the North has stagnated and turned inwards, becoming, over the past 60 years, an increasingly isolated, totalitarian Cold War relic. It has enough artillery pieces trained on the southern capital to turn it back into rubble, and it regularly threatens to do so. And yet here's a baffling thing. In downtown Seoul the other night, it was octopus and grilled meat as usual, bottles of the oily, sweet rice wine soju were being poured, bars and restaurants were busy with customers watching World Cup football, and all of them cheering for the enemy. I always support our brothers north of the border when they're playing other countries, one fan of the North Korean team told me. It's an even more remarkable scene from an outsider's perspective when you remember that just 3 months ago, according to the evidence produced by a multinational inquiry team, a North Korean submarine launched a torpedo attack on a South Korean warship, sinking it with the loss of 46 lives. The threat that war might flare up again is never far away, and the truth is, South Korea is a country still riven by the unfinished business of that conflict and the debate over how finally to resolve it. There are those who believe that the North should not be seen as an enemy at all, and that dialogue and engagement are the only way to bring about reconciliation. Others believe it to be a constant and present danger that should be stood up to and never appeased. My visits as a journalist to North Korea have been sobering and depressing experiences. Pyongyang, a place of heavy-handed oppression and control, with no visible signs of commerce, is less than 200 miles from Seoul, but it feels like another planet. The government of Kim Jong-il allows no opposition, no religious freedom, and no freedom of movement, and it sends those who step out of line to large forced labour camps, often accompanied by their families, including children. Perhaps, though, we shouldn't be too puzzled by South Korea's efforts to grapple with the thorny problem of its unchanging neighbour. There is a logic to the argument that embracing your foe is no less of a folly than backing him into a corner. And, after all, the vibrant and spirited debate taking place in the press, in the streets, and raging in the online chat rooms of this highly wired country is a tribute to the strength of its democracy. The contrast is not lost on the returning veterans when they are taken to the observation posts along the border, allowing them a glimpse of a North Korea still trapped in another era. Colonel Melese Tesima, for one, says he will go home to Ethiopia even more certain that his radio operator did not die in vain.
John Sudworth in Seoul. Two of the big aid organisations are warning that millions of people are in danger of starvation in the West African country Niger. The crisis has been caused by a combination of a crop failure following a drought last year and big increases in the price of many staple foods. Even before the rains failed repeatedly, this was a desperately poor nation. Oxfam and Save the Children, who are appealing for cash, say the situation's growing more critical by the day. Their concern is shared by the UN, which says the crisis is of a magnitude not seen before. Chris Stewart has just been travelling in Niger, and he found evidence of the emergency wherever he went.
If you look up Bo on the internet, nothing that makes sense comes up. But we were looking at a Bo, or rather looking for it. We were walking along the bank of the Niger River, searching for the tracks of a hippopotamus that was ravaging the corn on Karim's farm. All of a sudden, a lizard, about the size of a small crocodile, hurtled out of the undergrowth and skinned up a nearby baobab tree. "It's a Bo!" everybody cried, racing to the foot of the enormous tree. Now, I had never seen a boa before, so I was interested out of pure curiosity. The handful of villagers with us had other ideas, though. "The Bo is delicious," explained Karim. "It has the taste and texture of fish, and the inside of it is all white. You don't see them very often. There are not that many about." Mustafa, Karim's head man, was talking excitedly into his mobile phone. "He's calling the kids from the village," explained our host. "He wants them to climb the tree and get the poor creature down." It was hardly surprising, I thought, that the Bo was scarce. It's rotten luck to be a delicious animal in a land where people are hungry. For people are hungry in Niger. The rains failed last year, and the staple diet of millet is running out. There was famine in 1984 and again in 2005, and now it's about to happen once more. We travelled north to Tillabéré, a rolling landscape of sand, wind-blown dust and sparsely scattered bushes and trees, seemingly in the very last stages of desiccation. Here and there were thin cows, beautiful cows with tall horns, but with their hides hanging from fleshless frames. The goats, too, the lovely black and white African goat that looks as if it were jet black but had the front part of the body dyed white, have long ago given up hope of finding even the least scrap of sustenance from the parched earth. As we travelled on, the country became even more barren, with here and there a dead cow, others on their last legs, moving like wraiths among the leafless trees. This is not to say that the place was devoid of beauty. It possessed a tortured and hellish majesty. At length, we emerged from the nothingness we had passed through to a strange and unexpected scene, the wells of Timbululag. Dotted amongst the sparse trees were a dozen low mounds. On the top of each was a hole, the edges of which were defined with twisted logs set flush into the ground like wooden lips. Standing forlornly among the trees were scores of animals, patiently waiting to drink. In the shade of a particularly leafy tree sat a group of women, each enveloped in robes of beautifully printed cotton. Standing nearby, at one of the wells, was a corresponding group of men. "Salaam alaikum." They smiled in welcome as we shook their hands. They were a dozen or so, and they looked truly magnificent, tall and graceful, with skin of flawless black, and swathed in robes of blue, black and white. A proud-looking man stepped forward as spokesman. He was Akeli Mayaki, about 50 years old, and wearing a blue and white striped jalaba and an immaculate white turban. His people were destitute. Many of their cattle, their sole source of support, were now too weak to stand. There was hope that this year the rains would not fail, and that somehow they would come through. Hope there was, too, for the future. With improving education, perhaps it would never be this bad again. Finally, I asked him what I really wanted to know. How did he feel about this land he lived upon? Would he ever leave and go to the city in search of a less precarious existence? Akeli looked at me, weighing his words. Then he said, "When the rains come, and all these trees burst into leaf and flower, and the earth is deep in lush grass, then I tell you, there is no more beautiful place on this earth. I would not leave here, not even to go to Paris." Next, I turned to talk to the women, who reclined, each with her baby, in the dappled shade. They had a tin bowl full of what looked like dried bay leaves. "These are the leaves of the tatola tree," said the young spokeswoman. "We boil them and pound them and add a little salt. Then we put them with the millet husks, which are all that we have left now. The husks do not satisfy our hunger, but if we add some boiled leaves, it helps." Much later, far away back home in Spain, I got an email from Karim. "The village kids are still there, camped beneath the baobab, still waiting for the poor Bo to come down."
Christiat there. The Venezuelan capital, Caracas, is considered one of the most violent cities in the Americas. The socialist government of President Hugo Chavez says it's confronting the problem, partly through a new national police force. But the mayor of one opposition-run municipality, called Sucre, claims he's achieved a big reduction in crime in a year through a number of key changes to the force, such as paying higher wages and providing officers with new equipment. Will Grant has been out with the Sucre police as they patrolled Petare, a shantytown area notorious for its drug-related violence.
"Petare is like Las Vegas," says Municipal Police Chief Jorge Rosso. "You don't know if you're going to win or lose." Considering Petare's reputation for violence in Caracas, it's an ominous comment. Especially when he continues, "You could have a quiet night, or there could be gun battles. You won't know until you get there." As he's talking, we are strapping on black bulletproof vests and watching the policemen do the same. We'd brought our own body armour, but with a single glance, Commissioner Rosso changes it for their lighter vests. "You're going to be doing a lot of running up and down steps, and if you're carrying that," nodding towards our cumbersome war wear, "you won't last 5 minutes." At that point, the first emergency call comes in. A group of men, apparently dressed as police, have entered an apartment block in a richer neighbourhood near Petare and taken hostages. As we tumble into the patrol car, there is barely time for a proper introduction and a handshake with the two officers, both of whom are called González, before Officer Francisco González, who's driving, turns on the sirens and our evening begins. Within a few high-octane minutes of weaving through Caracas's infernal traffic, we are outside the building in question, where another set of policemen have already arrived. Guns drawn, they lead us into the main stairwell, and we start climbing, Commissioner Rosso's warning about the body armour still ringing in my ears. With sweat pouring off us, we reach the 8th floor, where the hostage situation, as the officers call it, is unfolding. But to all intents and purposes, there is no hostage situation. The men, whoever they were, have gone, taking jewellery and money with them, and leaving the residents shaken but unharmed. Once it's clear there is nothing more to be done, we're back in the police car and heading into the chaotic streets of Petare. It is Saturday night, when most people get paid, and Officer González says to expect a lot of drunkenness. In many ways, alcohol is a worse problem in these areas than drugs, he says, as we drive into what many in Venezuela describe as the most violent shantytown in Latin America. In fact, Petare isn't a single shantytown. It's a district made up of more than 1,000 separate brick shack neighbourhoods with more than 1 million residents. The officers tell us to switch off the lights of the camera for fear of snipers, and we start our way through the labyrinthine back alleys and steep stairways on foot. Stray dogs start barking furiously as we splash through the sewage and strewn rubbish with our boots. The occasional insult is hurled from the barred windows as we pass, and as the tension grows, what seemed like a simple enough assignment suddenly seems fraught with danger. We've been ambushed by the drug gangs in the past, the officers tell me later. We are running at a fair pace, the police stopping every few hundred metres to search another bemused youth carrying beers. The men and boys of Petare know what these foot patrols mean, and on seeing us they instinctively turn against the wall and prepare to be frisked. So far no one is carrying anything more incriminating than rum. You won't find anyone tonight, says one resident, adding cryptically, you know what's happening here. I assume he means that the gang members have been alerted to our presence and have moved into parts of Petare the police aren't likely to take us. As we come clattering around one corner, guns drawn and cameras rolling, like some kind of macabre reality TV show, we interrupt a group of older men playing dominoes with their shirts off in the stifling heat of the evening. Buenas noches, I mumble, feeling embarrassed by the intrusion. The thought that the police had laid on little more than a package tour for foreign journalists crosses my mind. The men smile as we continue past. The scenes outside Petare's main public hospital on a Saturday night are grim. We arrive as two young men are admitted following a shooting. A broad-shouldered woman, whose white vest is soaked in blood, is drinking neat rum out of the bottle to calm her nerves, while an older woman is slumped on the pavement in despair, praying. The 20-year-old boy inside with gunshot wounds is a relative. There seemed a strong chance he would end up as one of the 53 people who were murdered in Caracas over the weekend. It is almost 2 a.m, and we take a break to drink cold fruit juice. Reflecting on the changes the new mayor has made, Officer Gonzalez remains realistic about the job. We may have new boots and proper wages in this force, he says, but that's not enough. Everyone in Venezuela must help tackle this problem, from the president down.
Will Grant in Caracas. It's tornado season in the United States. Towns across the central belt of the country are bracing themselves for winds which can blow at up to 250 miles an hour and can cause spectacular destruction. Not everyone dreads the tornado, though. There's a group of people who call themselves storm chasers. They think there's nothing better than getting up close to these twisters. Hugh Cordy's discovered that you can even join a sort of tornado tour if you fancy living dangerously.
Top storm chaser Roger Hill is giving a morning briefing to his 13 clients, a group of mostly middle-aged men. The talk is much more serious than usual. We won't be going off-road today, he says, because if we get stuck, we could die. And when I say get back in the car, you get back in, or we'll leave you behind. By the end of today, he continues, people will have died, and lives will have changed forever. It all sounds a bit melodramatic, but then Roger knows a few things about violent tornadic supercells, as he likes to call these weather systems. He's seen more tornadoes than anyone else on the planet, currently 467, and the fact that he's still alive to tell the tales is more than a little comforting to his clients. Roger was just 9 when he saw his first tornado, though his tally could have ended here. One came through his hometown and carried away the family house, leaving an exhilarated Roger huddled in the cellar with his parents. Chasing days start slowly. Roger has never seen a tornado before 1 p.m., so mornings are all about getting into position. Sitting in the passenger seat of his vehicle, Roger flicks continuously between computer weather models, which are being constantly updated via satellite. There are often several options on where to go, so making the right call is everything, especially today when big things are expected. The forecast is so good that every storm chaser in the country seems to have descended on Oklahoma, They all have laptops set up in their vehicles, but I have a feeling that some storm chasers are keeping a closer eye on Roger and what he's doing than the weather models. After an hour or two of driving, we stop for lunch at a fast food restaurant. It's a familiar routine. The brand of hamburger is the only thing that changes. The diet of a storm chaser is terrible. If a tornado doesn't get you, a coronary might. While Roger ponders our next move, we sit waiting in the restaurant car park, another familiar routine. Suddenly, Roger shouts for everybody to get into the vans. The chase is on. 30 minutes later, we're standing by the vehicles watching a supercell, the cyclonic storms that form tornadoes, sweep across the landscape. We don't wait for long. There's no sign of a tornado yet, but the storm is moving at speed and Roger doesn't want to lose it. "Back in," he shouts. I'm following behind in a pickup, but Roger's not hanging around, and at a junction I lose him, so I fall in behind some other storm chasers. There are low clouds twisting ominously above our heads. They look as if they might form a tornado at any minute, but it's clear we've just missed one. Half a dozen telegraph poles have been laid flat, and at the side of the road we pass a SUV with all its windows blown out. The occupants look dazed, but otherwise okay. Later, at my motel, I meet this group of storm chasers, and they tell me a tornado hit their car side-on. They're not exaggerating. Another chaser shows me a video he took of the moment of impact. There's still no sign of Roger, but following other storm chasers, I find myself on a highway driving through the core of a supercell. The rain is coming down so hard I can barely see the front of the car. The conditions are terrifying, and in any other circumstance I would have pulled over, but I don't want to get left behind. I'm also worried about hail. In storm chaser parlance, supercell hail is always the size of baseballs, or at the very least, golf balls. Either way, the windscreen would end up on my lap. I phone Roger on the mobile to find out what I should be doing. His first response is not very comforting. "Where are you?" he shouts. "It's a matter of life and death." Turns out that Roger could see a tornado forming on his computer models and thought it was heading straight for where he figured I was. A case of the storm chaser being chased by the storm. Several hours later, and having failed to catch up with Roger, I arrive back in the motel. On the local news channel, I see footage of the day's violent storms. 14 tornadoes have been confirmed. There's an aerial shot of a huge tornado with a cloud of debris at its base. Then, the devastating aftermath of its trail. A trailer park, school and petrol station have been flattened. 6 people have died. Lives have undoubtedly been changed forever.
Hugh Cordy, amid the perils of Tornado Alley, and bringing this edition to a close. I'll be here again with more from our own correspondents on Thursday and Saturday of next week. Until then, goodbye.